There's been a lot of action in the state assembly and Senate over the last few days. The legislature passed a slew of bills on things from high-capacity wells to opioid drug abuse bills.
Sean Johnson joins us now for a look at the news from the state capitol. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. And Sean, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with what passed in the assembly. Lawmakers there approved legislation that loosened regulations on high-capacity wells. This is something that has been debated, percolating for quite a while now. So what changes under this bill?
Yeah, this is a big bill that's been debated for a while and looks like it's going to become law. It applies to existing wells, and it says that a landowner can repair or replace or sell an existing well without getting a new environmental permit or review from the Department of Natural Resources. This is something that the state's agriculture industry has pushed for pretty heavily, especially the dairy industry, particularly vegetable growers and potato growers in central Wisconsin. And it's something that environmental groups and Central Sands area landowners have fought pretty vigorously, because you have lakes and streams in that region that are drying up as more and more high-capacity wells are drilled in that area.
And under this new bill, so for instance, if a landowner sold their property, the person who bought that property, what could they do?
The well essentially goes with it, and so they're not going to be in danger of losing the permit for that well just because they bought it and, it has to go through a new set of review.
And this is on the governor's desk for his review. Is he expected to sign this?
I'd be very surprised if Governor Walker did not sign this. I don't think he's explicitly said, I'm going to sign this, but he's given every indication that he would. All but one Republican legislator voted for this in the Assembly and the Senate. Governor Walker said good things about it. His spokesman has too.
Another one, state representatives approved a bill eliminating the need for work permits for 16 and 17-year-olds in Wisconsin. What's behind this one, Sean?
Yeah, so essentially right now, 16 and 17-year-olds are supposed to get a work permit to be employed in Wisconsin, and getting that work permit means getting a signature from a parent or a guardian. This bill would take that requirement away. The argument behind it is that there are some 16 and 17-year-olds who might need work but can't get this work permit because their parents aren't involved in their lives the way that they should be. The argument against it is you're taking away a protection that's a child labor protection, essentially, and you're making it easier for businesses to lean on younger employees to run their businesses.
And, Sean, again, a busy week in the legislature. What else happened in the assembly?
It was very big, I guess, week for them in terms of the number of bills that passed. You had them talking about an Every Student Succeeds Act, which is a plan that every state has to draw up under federal guidance. In our case, the state plan was drawn up by the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. This plan would essentially just give the legislature a chance to ask questions of the DPI. You had a number of Republican lawmakers saying we ought to have that say. The thing is, the catch, and it's a big one, is it can't require the DPI to make changes to the plan. So, that is a bill that a lot of Republican lawmakers like in theory, but in reality it doesn't do a whole lot. There are also a number of bills that the Assembly passed aimed at curbing homelessness.
And looking now at the opioid abuse issue in Wisconsin, this has been a big one, a lot of legislature ongoing there. What did we see yesterday in terms of movement on opioid abuse legislation?
What you saw is a couple things. You saw the Senate pass 9 bills, sent them to the governor's desk, and those by and large are aimed at treatment options for opioid addicts. So, in a variety of different ways, whether it be creating a small charter school for opioid addicts at the University of Wisconsin, or just increasing funding for existing treatment programs. Those 9 bills kind of get at that. You also saw, though, yesterday, the State Assembly take up a couple bills that haven't passed the Senate, including one that would essentially say that if somebody is overdosing on an opioid and calls the police or checks themselves into a hospital, they would be immune from prosecution. It's similar to an existing law Wisconsin has for people who call the police or take someone to the hospital they won't get in trouble for it.
And Representative John Nygren, a Republican from Marinette, this has been something he's been especially involved in, this sort of opioid legislation. And he has said that offenders would only get immunity under certain conditions. Here he is.
So what we're doing is we're allowing for the immunity with some exceptions or with some strings attached. We're allowing the limited immunity to flow to the person that's overdosing as long as they either get treatment, get into a drug court, or enter into a deferred prosecution requiring those things.
And this one, this is a change that isn't necessarily a done deal for everybody. It sounds like there was some objection.
Yeah, it's a little bit uncomfortable for some Republicans. You heard from Powers Lake Republican Samantha Kirkman last night say she appreciates all the effort here by Representative Nygren, but she couldn't back it.
I just can't support this bill, and I do appreciate the amendments to the bill. I think the amendments make current law better, and they make this bill better, but we still are giving immunity to somebody who might have killed somebody through heroin.
So she's essentially saying that, you know, these people are engaging in behavior they know is risky that could put other people's health at risk when they overdose. And she didn't want to take that step to offer them protection from punishment just because they call police or they check themselves into a hospital.
And we're going to keep going in a little bit as we talk with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, looking at the latest from the state legislature so far this weekend. And we'll be picking up that conversation in just a few minutes. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. He's sharing the details of the news from the state capitol so far this week. A lot going on.
And Sean, the state senate also passed a measure that it changed administrative rules. This one sounds a little dry. You think, okay, this is wonky legislative stuff. It's not going to be that interesting, but it sounds as though the substance of the arguments behind it and also the potential impact are bigger than that.
I thought it was just, we just broke this out because it's pledge and we do all the exciting topics for pledge. No, I mean, it was a pretty big change to administrative rules in terms of the amount of power that it gives legislators when it comes to rules. So just to backtrack a little bit, administrative rules are like the fine details of laws. So when legislature passes a bill, gets signed into law, it directs policy experts at state agencies to kind of fill in the blanks. They do that through administrative rules. What this bill says is that if those rules drawn up by agencies are found to cost more than $10 million, they are automatically blocked. They're put on hold. And the only way they get taken off hold is if the legislature passes another bill. So one of the many ways in which this bill gives the legislature more power over the rulemaking process. This is something that business groups like a lot, but this is something that Democrats, environmental groups don't like at all.
Well, and it sounds as though if a business didn't hit that dollar threshold, they could hire an outside consulting firm to take a look at that number, and maybe that firm would come back with a different number, and then you're in the ballgame again.
Exact, yes. So the initial estimate would come from the government. And if an agency said, no, we think this is actually going to cost $5 million, the legislature could, if they didn't believe that, they could go out and hire an outside firm. Critics say this will essentially let them shop around for the firm that's going to give them the number that they're looking for.
And as you said, some celebrating these changes. Republican State Senator Devin Lemieux, the measure sponsor, said lawmakers should celebrate this and think it's a good thing.
This is an exciting day for the legislature in the state of Wisconsin. What it does is it shifts the power back to us, the elected officials, in the rulemaking process.
So can you expand a little bit more on why Lemieux is behind this one?
Well, I mean, this is something that businesses have asked for the past couple of sessions. Actually, it was one of those rare issues where business didn't get what it was looking for last session because not all the business groups were on the same page with this. But it's something that they want. They feel like that it will, protect them from rules that are especially costly. Again, critics, though, feel like it prioritizes those costs to businesses or puts a premium on those, but it ignores the benefits of laws that pass the legislature. I mean, there's presumably reasons that legislatures pass the laws sometimes to protect consumers, the public, and they say that's ignored in all this.
And some strong opposition that you heard from State Senator Kathleen Vino, Democrat from Alma. She called the plan, she used the word insidious and said that it prioritized the costs to business over the public good. And here she is.
This is the broadest, most dangerous bill you've never heard of. It's an obscure way to shut down government from doing something that the legislature intended it to do.
And Sean, what is next for this one?
This one still has to clear the state assembly. But this is, I think that the passage out of the Senate with all but one Republican is, definitely momentum in that bill.
So, Sean, moving on, the Senate also passed a bill that would allow delivery drones in Wisconsin. Tell us about this. What would this change?
Just legalizing robots, basically. They look kind of like a cooler, a large cooler. They've got wheels. As long as they're, under 80 pounds and go no faster than 10 miles per hour, these delivery drones under this bill would be able to operate on Wisconsin sidewalks.
I thought drones flew, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen this referred to in a number of different ways. So this isn't a drone that flies through the sky. This is something that would be rolling down the sidewalk.
Okay. It's more like a droid from Star Wars.
I was thinking maybe like Johnny Number 5 from Short Circuit or something like that.
So there's new technology coming to Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I mean, this passed the Senate on a voice vote. In other words, nobody registered their opposition to it. You did hear some criticism, though, from Janet Buley, a Democrat from northern Wisconsin, who said, we're essentially celebrating a technology that's going to take away jobs from people here, that these are jobs being done by people now. This is not exactly a cause for celebration to, as we keep seeing technology like this, take those jobs away.
And Sean, other big news, I guess, depending on your perspective, cheese
it's
is almost Wisconsin's official state dairy product. Maybe for some people, a surprise is that, what do you mean? Cheese wasn't already the state's official dairy product, but it wasn't, it turns out. And the Senate advanced the measure to Governor Walker's desk. What happens now that cheese is being elevated?
I'm going to guess he's probably going to sign this one.
Can you imagine if he didn't?
Well, there are some ceremonial bills that go through the legislature, and when they happen, you'll sometimes hear the minority party criticize the majority party for wasting the public's time, etc. You haven't heard that with this cheese bill. It was an idea generated from fourth graders in the Senate district of Republican Senator Howard Markline. They followed it through. It's coasting on through. Senator Markline says it's finally time cheese gets its due.
I see. And Sean, before we let you go, do you have a favorite Wisconsin cheese?
I'm going to go with sharp cheddar.
Ah, classic.
Yeah, maybe a Parmesan sometimes.
Nice. Those are good choices. Well, Sean, thanks a lot for coming on and talking to me.
All right. You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, joining us to share the latest news from the state capitol so far this week.
Republican lawmakers are still pushing for a vote on a health care plan that would repeal and replace, the phrase goes, Obamacare.
An amendment adding $8 billion in spending may tip some lawmakers in favor of the bill, but House leaders are still counting the votes to see if they have enough support.
Paul Singer joins us now to recap that and some other top stories in national politics. He's USA Today's Washington correspondent. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, and thanks for having me on Pledge Day. Everybody should be donating.
Well, it sounds like there's a pledge of $8 billion trying to pass this plan through the House, Paul. This has been going since that dramatic day when the bill didn't come to a vote. There's been this percolating back and forth. What's the latest effort to get enough Republican votes to pass this thing?
Well, you're right. It is $8 billion over a period of 4 years, I believe, pay for it's called high-risk pools. The whole theory here is they want to do two things at once. They want to give the conservatives the victory in repealing a bunch of mandatory standards that were created by Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that is mandatory standards for insurance policies. At the same time, they want to give moderates the right to say that some of those mandatory standards have been protected. And in this case, we're talking about the protection for pre-existing conditions. Obamacare famously said that you can't be denied coverage for your pre-existing condition. So now, the way the bill is written, it would allow states to seek a waiver so that, in fact, you could be denied coverage for pre-existing condition. But in order to make the moderates happy, they say, okay, well, here's $8 billion basically to go into a pool that would help you buy coverage if your state gets a waiver. It is a very complex bit of math they are executing. So here's the question. Does that satisfy the conservatives enough while also satisfying the moderates enough to get this bill to pass? And remember, we're talking just about the Republicans. Not a single Democrat is going to vote for this thing. At the moment, we don't know if they have the votes.
And this is Republicans in the House. This isn't even talking about the Senate yet. Whether, even if they can pass something, there's the question of whether the Senate would give it the time of day.
Correct. By most accounts, there is not enough support in the Senate to pass any of this stuff. It will be renegotiated again if they I don't honestly even know if they would take up the framework. But, you know, for a lot of the moderates, they view this problem is the way the bill is drafted. It's going to raise premiums in the near term on their elderly, particularly constituents, and it is also going to reduce coverage for their Medicaid recipients, and they think that that's bad news.
Some people have said, hey, what's the rush here? These new changes, including this new $8 billion, hasn't been scored by the Congressional Budget Office. What would be the rush? Why do Republican House leaders feel like they're under time pressure here?
Well, you really don't want to know the answer to this question, but...
Oh, I do.
it gets complicated fast. Because they're trying to do this through something called budget reconciliation, which is the way that you can pass legislation with a 50-vote majority in the Senate instead of needing a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority, you do it on a budget bill. The problem is they want to do tax reform on a budget bill, too, and for that... they need to pass a second budget bill. It would be basically next year's budget. They're doing this one, the health care bill, under this year's budget. And the premise is you can't do them both at the same time. You can't have two budget bills live at once. So you got to get health care out of the way so that you can open the door to do tax reform.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at some of the top stories in the news. So before we move on from healthcare, Paul, I mean, what's going on? They're counting votes one at a time in the House to see if they got this thing?
They are. One of my reporters is over there right now. The House just had a vote, and she sent me an email back saying, well, I asked for interviews for a bunch of the undecided members, and none of them came to talk to us. So I suspect the Republican leadership is doing exactly what my reporters are doing, which is trying to corner these people in a hallway and ask them whether they're a yes or a no.
Well, I want to talk for a minute about an interesting piece you wrote yourself, Paul. You get to write stuff sometimes.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
Every now and then.
We often hear before an election, if candidate blank wins, I'm moving to Canada. And there's a lot of this with right. If Trump wins... people would say they were going to move to Canada, they didn't want to be part of America run by Donald Trump. You hit the streets, you hit the pavement, and you tried to dig up whether more people had been filing to move to Canada. What did you discover?
Well, we discovered the answer is a little bit yes, but not really a big yes. They every year, the average of Americans getting permanent residence in Canada for the past decade or so has ranged between 8 and 10,000 people. The first quarter of this year, there was about 2,300 Americans who relocated, got permanent residence into Canada. That's up somewhat from the first quarter of last year and the first quarter of the year before, like up by a couple of hundred. But the quarters, you know they sort of variable. Some quarters it's 1,900, some quarters it's 1,500. If this kept up at this rate, you get to 9,000, 9,500 American move to Canada this year. That would be a big year. It would not be a historically big year, but it would be a big year. But we just don't know whether it's really going to keep up with that rate. And even if it does, I don't think it shows a stampede. And there's a lawyer we've talked to a couple times up there who said, you know, people move to Canada for two reasons. They get a job or they get married. That's basically it. Very few people are up here because they're running from the politics of America.
So this is not a great, if I can paraphrase H. Ross Perot, a great sucking sound of Americans having to cross the border.
I don't think so. Now, again, call me back in 3 months. We'll see what the second quarter of 2017 is, and if we're up to, you know, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people by then maybe we're into something. And I will say that I've seen a couple of interesting comments from folks that one of the things that's happening is that non-Americans are going to Canada, which is to say, if you're here as on a visitor's visa, you might relocate to Canada because you just don't think at this point the Trump administration is going to extend your visitor status in America, so you're looking for somewhere else to go. That's possible, harder to track.
Getting back to Congress and money and funding stuff, now there was this question of maybe a shutdown coming up. We heard earlier this week Democrats, Republicans agreed on this deal. Looks like some voting is maybe happening, has happened on that today. But President Trump has said on Twitter, he said maybe in September or so in the fall when this thing expires, we need a good shutdown. The phrase good shutdown was in one of his tweets I'm not sure what. What did you make of what he was arguing there?
I don't know. It's very hard to make anything of it. No one in government has ever used the word good in the same sentence as the word shutdown. It is clear that Mr. Trump did not get everything he wanted in the funding bill that just passed 15 minutes ago. He wants money for his border wall, particularly. He wants more money for defense spending. He wants deeper cuts in discretionary spending, you know, in the various federal agencies. So maybe he is signaling with that rather oddly timed tweet that he is willing to go to the mat over this, and if it comes down to it, he will shut down the government rather than accept a compromise with Democrats. Every Republican saw that tweet and shook their head and said, no way, we don't want it. We've been through this before, and we get blamed. But who knows? I mean, with Mr. Trump, it's always hard to tell whether the president is, you know, staking out a negotiating position, or he's just in a bad mood and tweeting.
And he also complained about the filibuster rule in the Senate, which people have done over the years. But he said that's part of the reason we're not getting what we want. And he said, in effect, we need to do what we did for what Harry Reid did for many judges, what the Republicans now did for the Supreme Court, and get rid of the filibuster now for budget measures. Have we heard anything from leading Republicans in the Senate on that?
Yes, we have. Mitch McConnell said, over my dead body. The problem for any majority party getting rid of the filibuster is that someday you're going to be the minority party. And the reason the filibuster exists, by and large, is to prevent the Senate from becoming the House. The House is the place where the minority has no rights whatsoever. The majority of the moment can just stampede their way through their agenda. The country does not really want to be whipsawed every couple of years when you change leadership, and a majority of 51 in the Senate could basically rewrite the entire law book. It's not good politics. It's not good policy.
I want to turn to foreign policy for a moment. Syria, obviously still in the news. President Trump talking to President Vladimir Putin in Russia, talking about an effort to come to a ceasefire. Are we seeing maybe room for genuine cooperation there, something that could actually work on the ground?
You know, I don't know much about foreign policy in general, and I got to tell you that Mr. Trump's foreign policy has been a little all over the place, particularly regards to Syria. It's not clear to me what the agenda is. It was hopeful, I think, to see him reaching out to Mr. Putin, and a conversation can be held. That's good, because 3 weeks ago, I guess it is now, we bombed Syria, suggested that the Russians had been complicit in the Syrians' use of chemical weapons on their own people, and had gotten to this point where basically the most powerful players in the region, us and the Russians, were not on speaking terms about how to solve this problem. So at least there is speaking going on. But it's really hard to know what the resolution is. I mean, the Russians have said all along that they don't see a reason to get rid of Assad, and they see him as basically one of their pawns or protectorates, and we don't. So I don't know exactly how this resolves in a way that works out for both. But I think the best part of that conversation was everybody agreeing that, you know, we need to figure out ways to resolve the conflict and help the humanitarian crisis. Whether we get anywhere from there to a solution, I do not know.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks a lot, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You You too. That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He joined us for our weekly look at the latest in national politics.